I don't necessarily want to rush things, but since it's after 7, and I'm supposed to talk tonight, and I've got other places to go after I get done talking here, I would just soon talk. So, my name is Leon Knight, and my topic for tonight is women, the sexism in mental health, or sexism in the healthcare industry in Minnesota. And so I want to talk about that.
May we just sit down? Why don't we go right
Yes,
down?
Okay.
We're waiting for you out there.
Oh, I've been in here since about 20 minutes before 7.
Oh, okay.
So, okay.
This well, is Dr. Least, Kreuter and she'll introduce you. Then.
Okay. I'm glad that our meeting has started.
Good evening, ladies. Would you fill out one of these evaluation sheets before you leave tonight and drop it off at the table out there in the hall? This evening we're going to discuss health care and mental care in Minnesota, and Dr. Kreuter from St. Olaf College will introduce the speakers. Gretchen?
Well, this is a bit anticlimactic, I must say.
And since Mr. Knight had begun, I think I will just let Mr. Knight continue, and then I'll introduce to you Rosemary Dilworth. Thank you.
Okay. I'm what's known as a pushy feminist, so... I'll tell you how I got interested in this particular topic, and it's very personal. I'm an English teacher in a community college, and you rightfully can ask, well, what on earth does an English teacher in a community college know about sexism in medical care? And I got interested in the topic in a very simple way. Two members of my family, my wife and my daughter, both received treatment that we consider to be very sexist. My wife, who has allergies, was a patient at this particular clinic, and the medicine that had been prescribed, it was a broad-based kind of allergy treatment. And after a couple years of taking this particular medication, now, we didn't realize the connection at that particular time, but after a couple of years, she started developing some symptoms that were unusual in the sense of having unaccountable headaches, being unaccountably irritable, and so on. So she went back to the clinic to ask, well, now, what's wrong? Well, the first question that was asked her was, how's your marriage? And she said, well, what do you mean? You know, my marriage is fine. I said, well, what about the kids? She said, well, the kids are grown up, married, gone away. So, well, maybe that's your trouble. You just don't have a satisfying life. Well, this really irritated her. So we got out of there. When she got home, she just sat down and thought, now, if I were a doctor and somebody came in to me with these symptoms, what would I do? And she thought, the first thing I would do is look at what kind of medication the person was on. And so the medication she was on was this allergy stuff. So she just took herself off of the allergy medicine, and within a couple of days, all of these other symptoms had cleared up. Of course, the allergies came back. So then she went to a specialist at another clinic, and he said, oh, yeah, this is a possible side effect of that particular medication. And the question that the doctor had raised when she went back is, oh, is your marriage all right? Are you getting along with your kids? Is your husband mistreating you? In other words, assuming that a middle-aged woman coming in with unaccountable headaches must be automatically suffering from some kind of woman's problem. So that irritated us. Then my daughter, when she was giving birth to her second baby, she came back from overseas. She had a bad heart. She had a heart operation in 68. Then in 73, when the second baby was being born, her husband then wanted her close to the heart hospital, so she came home to be home here when the baby was born. And it was a good thing, because when the baby was born, my daughter's heart failed. So the doctors suggested to her, and she readily agreed, that she should have a tubal ligation, because to get pregnant again would be probably be fatal. Well, the hospital wouldn't allow the doctors to perform that particular operation without her husband's permission. She told him, she said, look, doesn't matter what my husband wants, if I get pregnant again, I might die. And so if he insists on having more kids, he's going to have them by some woman other than me. But the only way that we could work this out so she could have that operation was to telephone overseas and have somebody on the hospital staff hear him say, yes, that operation is all right. Now, that really irritated us too. And not only that, we had to make two long distance calls because he got so excited about the birth of the kid and everything, he hung up before the hospital person could hear him say that. And so, I didn't think of it at the time, but we should have deducted that second telephone call from the hospital bill when it came through, because but we had to call a second time. Well, those two things got me interested in this particular subject, just how sexist is medical care in for women. Now I'll tell you another little story, and then I'll stop the personal anecdotes, because we could go on with that all night. It's kind of interesting, just about every time I mention this to some women, a group of three or four, one or another will bring up an incident. And so you could go down just incident after incident of this kind of treatment. Well, a friend of mine, a woman, had a couple cancer operations. And her doctor suggested to her that she not get pregnant again. But he didn't want her taking the birth control pills because of the possible side effects with the birth control pills. And so he suggested to her that then she have a tubal ligation. And again, it couldn't be performed without her husband's permission, and her husband had to be the type of guy who wouldn't give the permission. And which is kind of interesting, because as far as I know, a man to get a vasectomy does not need his wife's permission. But this tubal ligation, that it's necessary to get the husband's permission. And so this woman now, after already having had two cancer operations, now is taking the birth control pills so she won't get pregnant again, because that will be dangerous to her. And the possible side effects of the birth control pills might be further dangerous in terms of cancer. I suggested to her, though just facetiously, there was another way of solving the problem, and that was just tell the guy go someplace else if he was to have a little sex, you know. But I don't know whether that would work out all that well anyway. So this got me interested. These incidents, my very private personal things, got me interested. And there's a couple things in my reading and my just talking that I've come across that I think are terribly, terribly important. And the first thing is just the institutional sexism. Not necessarily the sexism of the individual doctors. In fact, the sexism of individual doctors, individual medical care practitioners, is by and large irrelevant in comparison to the sexism of the institutions themselves. And the sexism starts off with the admission to medical school. And it's not only just a sexist determination in terms of who gets admitted to medical school, but there's also a class distinction. Because by and large, unless you are a white, male, upper middle class, come from that kind of background, your chances of being admitted to medical school are very low. Because the pressure of the systems will direct you, if you come from lower classes or if you're female, into other types of service professions, things like social work, or if you're a woman, nursing. Right now, for example, I think amongst the medical doctors, only about 7% are female, though the current entering class, I think this year the figure has raised, there's now about 18% of the entering students this year are female. But even at that, 18%, when the majority of medical health practitioners are female, and yet still only 18% this year are going into the medical doctor profession, which of course is the power structure of the thing. So this thing, the, and related to that, of course, is that the women are directed then toward the nursing profession. And it's kind of interesting how this comes about. It really must be pervasive. My granddaughter, who is 4, one day I was talking to her, and we were playing and so on, and she then said that she wanted to be a nurse. And so I suggested, well, why do you want to be a nurse? Why not be a doctor? And she said, well, I can't be a doctor. She says, I'm a girl. And it's kind of interesting because her personal doctor is a woman. See, but even though her personal doctor is a woman, that's so much a part of society that the doctor is a man. And as far as I know, that you know, it's kind of interesting. I'll tell you a little, when I get talking about my grandchildren, I got all kinds of stories. But one day I asked her what she wanted to be when she grows up. She said, when she grew up, she wanted to have big titties like Mama and Grandma. So, and she's 4 years old. You know, it comes early, I guess. But one of the problems with the nursing profession is the conflict between the mothering role, the nurturing role, and what might be called the more professional role of nurses. And there's much evidence to indicate that, by and large, the nurturing, mothering kind of role for nurses has come about not because that is necessarily the best role for nurses to be in, but primarily because women have gone into nursing. That it was a role that was induced by the training that the little girl received when she was young to be a woman, not so much to be a nurse. And so often then, the nursing schools, they run into a conflict. Do they train the nurses to be more professionally oriented, or do they train them for the way it is in fact going to be? Because there was an article I read called Women in Medicine that made the claim that often the nurse faces the problem of, what does she do? Her goal is to get good medical care for her patient. But sometimes, in order to get this good medical care, she cannot offend the male doctor's ego. Because if she asserts herself in a self-respecting way, that then the male doctor might be so affronted as to delay, you know, because he's got to work this thing out with the nurse, to delay the appropriate treatment for the patient. And so the nurse, who might be self-assertive and so on, faces the problem. Do I humiliate myself in one sense and be subservient to this male doctor's ego, and then get faster, better treatment for my patient? Or do I assert myself in more self-respecting behavior and perhaps delay the treatment? And so this is the thing that nurses are constantly faced with. Florence Kennedy, and I would think many of you might be familiar with her, she wasn't necessarily talking about the medical profession of this, but she had something to say about this, and I'll quote her directly. She says, "Where a system of oppression has become institutionalized, it is unnecessary for individuals to be oppressive." See? And I want to throw out that word of caution to you. And I'll say this as a man, that quite often what we men do to women who might be assertive, and women who might say, well, they've been receiving sexist treatment and so on, we'll try to turn it into a personalized thing. Well, you can't mean me. You know, I'm not sexist in the way I treat you. Whether I'm sexist in the way I treat you is not is totally irrelevant. If the institution is sexist, I don't have to be sexist. I'll still benefit by the sexism of the institution. So don't, if you make any feminist times a push and you get that particular kind of response, I might just warn you that that don't play the game, because we will try to get you to play that game. Well, maybe sexism is bad, but I'm all right. That kind of thing. Well, don't play that particular game when it's brought up. The question then naturally comes up, then why has sexism become so institutionalized? And there's a couple things that struck me. One is just about the history of medicine. You know, it wasn't until the late Middle Ages where male doctors could treat a woman who was in labor for childbirth. And I've, little fact struck me when it hit me, when I came across that. And then, in my reading in literature, I came across something else. You might be familiar with the old tradition, may perhaps have heard about it. I don't know how pervasive it was, but in England, the tradition of the lord of the manor deflowering the virgin bride of some subordinate. And, you know, we like to think here in 20th century America, oh, it's just some dirty old duke, you know, who takes advantage of. Well, what it was, in fact, from my reading, and this in literature, was that men thought that a woman's blood was evil. And so it was the most powerful man around who was the only one who stood the best chance of withstanding the woman's evil power. And so the blood that's often associated with the deflowering of a virgin then send the most powerful man there to withstand that evil. Well, all what I'm suggesting here is that this institutionalized sexism, including the sexism in the medical profession, as far as I can see, is simply an extension of the idea that woman is the source of evil, and that this evil power is primarily sexual blood power. Now, this has, I think, a particular role to play in terms of the mental health profession, because I got kind of interested in that when it was suggested that my wife was something mentally wrong with her because she was taking those allergy pills, you know. But there's a study that was carried out, and it's reported in this little book here. It's a really kind of fascinating little book you might be interested in. It's called Sex Role Stereotypes Revisited, Psychological Approaches to Women's Study by Rhoda Kessler Unger. But she reports a study that was carried out in 1970, and it was a fascinating study. The study took a group of mental health practitioners, psychologists, psychiatrists, and psychiatric social workers, and including both men and women. And these men and women mental health practitioners were asked to rate the characteristics of a normal adult male with good mental health, the characteristics of a mature adult woman with good mental health, and thirdly, a healthy, mature, socially competent adult person. See, now they didn't realize what the thrust of the study actually was, but it's that third group that's carries the kicker in it. Now, both male and female mental health workers there was no difference in the way they defined men, women, and adults. And the thing that was kind of interesting, healthy women, according to both the male and female mental health clinicians, said that healthy women differ from healthy men by being more submissive, more independent, less venturesome, less objective, more easily influenced, less aggressive, less competitive, more excitable in minor crises, more emotional, more conceited about their appearance, and having their feelings hurt more easily. Now, both men and women mental health practitioners came to that conclusion. But the thing that was interesting was that when they just rated an adult with good mental health, the characteristics of the adult were almost exactly the characteristics of the man. Now, I don't know if you realize the significance of that, but what it means essentially is that a woman is damned if she does or damned if she doesn't. She can either act like a woman or like an adult. She cannot be both, according to the mental health profession. So you make your choice. Are you going to be feminine and childlike, or are you going to be adult and unfeminine? And so either way, see, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. And the mental health practitioners, whether male or female, support that particular concept. So if you ever get in a situation where you need mental health, submit yourself to a mental health practitioner, I would suggest you check that person out very carefully to see just where that person's coming from, because you may not like it. There was another thing in a book called Women and Madness that was, I came across a very interesting quotation. Because depression is a thing about women that happens much more often than happens for men in terms of mental health. But depressed women are less verbally hostile and aggressive than non-depressed women, and their depression may serve as a way of keeping deadly faith with the feminine role. Did you get that point? It's very significant as far as I'm concerned. That many women fall into depression, perhaps at middle age, you know, the way they thought my wife was, because if you don't like the way that your life is going, if you get verbal and aggressive about it, then you're no longer feminine. Because feminine women are not verbal and aggressive and the rest of it. So if you get hostile about it, you're not feminine. So the depression is often a way of keeping deadly faith with their feminine role. Now, since I am an English teacher, I'd like to refer to a couple poems, and then I'll quit here and turn it over to someone else here. Anne Sexton, you may be familiar with her. Here's a poem that she wrote, and it's called Said the Poet to the Analyst. My business is words. Words are like labels or coins, or better, like swarming bees. I confess I'm only broken by the sources of things, as if words were counted like dead bees in the attic, unbuckled from their yellow eyes and their dry wings. I must always forget how one word is able to pick out another, to manner another, until I have got something I might have said, but did not. Your business is watching my words, but I admit nothing. I work with my best. For instance, when I write my praise for a nickel machine that one night in Nevada, telling how the magic jackpot came clacking three bells out over the lucky screen. But if you should say this is something it is not, then I grow weak, remembering how my hands felt funny and ridiculous and crowded with all the believing money. Now, I want to repeat a couple of lines in here that I think are very important. I must always forget how one word is able to pick out another and manner another until I have got something I might have said but did not. And then a later line, and I think this is particularly appropriate to what I was talking about before. Remember, it's the poet talking to the analyst. If you should say, this is something it is not, then I grow weak. So if the analyst says, you do something, and he says, this is something it is not, then I grow weak. Because of my profession, English teacher, I believe in the power of words. And the power of definition is a real power. As far as I can see, that's what the feminist movement is about. For women to get control of their own definitions about what it means to be female. And it's a real power. And thus far, women have not had that power. And I'd like to end with this little poem here. We reach for destinies beyond what we have come to know. And in the romantic hush of promises, perceive each other, the other's life, as known mystery, shared but inviolate. No melting, no squeezing into one. We swing our eyes around as well as side to side to see the world, to choose, renounce this or that. Call it a council between equals. Call it love. Okay, that's it.
Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to introduce to you Rosemary Dilworth, who is a nurse at the University Hospitals, and a nurse with an interest in history, particularly the history of women and women's involvement in the healthcare professions. And she's going to give us some background, some historical framework within which to put some of the kinds of things that Mr. Knight has already described to you. Rosemary?
I almost feel more like I want to argue and discuss than start going into what I was talking about. But when I was asked to write this essay, I started out with the idea that the development of a type structure and ever-growing socialization or specialization in the medical professions over the last half century has occurred with a loss of authority for the majority of the women in the health services. And it was in the beginning days of statehood that women had a lot more autonomy, a lot more power, and that's sort of what I'm hoping to tell you about. I'm also very nervous about talking about it, and I don't know why, because normally I'm very comfortable that I've always talked about nursing things, and all of a sudden here I'm doing something on history, and I'm just, all my facts are just going all over the place. So my voice is going to shake for a while until I hope I get used to talking. In the early times, the midwives, and I'll stay in Minnesota. I'm talking about Minnesota unless I refer to other places, were the only obstetrical resource for most women, regardless of race or heritage. The nuns were the women who organized the first hospitals in the state, and they continued to administer these hospitals. By the 1880s, women doctors, thank you. By the 1880s, women doctors were establishing practices, and some of them were also founding hospitals. Nursing schools began about the same period. They offered the average woman a new opportunity to apprentice herself into a career. Before, it was just teaching, or they worked out as hired girls or whatever, but now the nursing was opening up. It was the needs of a young and growing state that enabled these women to realize their potential in a way that would not be possible in modern times. There was no one to say, you can't do this, because the need was there and they were there to fill it. The first women, and again, this is white women, I'll talk about Indians later, the first women on the frontier to practice the healing arts were not the doctors, but were, as has been mentioned before, the midwives. Mrs. Abraham Perret, P-E-R-R-E-T, the first midwife of community stature in St. Paul, lived on the site of the old Anchor Hospital. Her name, Mary Ann, was a household word, not only with settlers, but with the wives of military men at Fort Snelling. And the army wives obviously would prefer her to the military surgeons. And when the Fort Snelling Reservation, which used to extend to Seven Corners, which was cut back when they expelled all the squatters, Mary Ann was not expelled. Her daughter, later Miss Adele, later Mrs. Vidal Guerin, died at 87 in 1914, and she succeeded her mother as the community's principal midwife. She lived on the bluff side of Kellogg Boulevard, just below Wabasha, in a cabin, and aided in the births of many early children born in the present Loop area. This mother-daughter concept is an important one when you know about midwives, and this was all over the United States, and that was that the United States has never really had good midwife schools. They've always used the tutorial system, which is not made for a strong professional grounding for midwives, because it was the grandmother teaching the mother teaching the daughter, and it did seem to be handed down from, you probably can think of examples in your own lives, and this is a good written example of how this happened. There's not too much known. Oh, I found the microphone again. There's not too much known about the obstetrical practices among the Indians of Minnesota. I went down through the manuscript boxes of the Rosenthal collection at the Historical Society, and I don't know. He is a man who wrote to various doctors in various counties, and all of these typewritten sheets have come in. I don't know exactly the sources of them, but they are in the Historical Society, so there must be some verification for them. This doctor is writing in 1876, and he talks about the Chippewa Indians. He was not, by the way, allowed to do any obstetrical work among the Indians, the midwives of the Indians, and this is the Chippewa, but it was true of most of the Indian tribes. The Indians, the women took care of the women. He had not ever seen a case. He had once seen one case of what he called puerperal mania, which would be postpartum psychosis, I would imagine. And the woman was tied to a tree and raging around the tree, but later she was cured. In the case of miscarriage, the doctor saw his patient about 2 hours afterwards, and when she was then on her knees in the wigwam washing the clothes, it was customary among the women to get up immediately after the child was born and go to work. Or if delivery occurred while on the march, as soon as it was over, the mother picked up her pack and proceeded on her journey. Nevertheless, uterine disease of any kind was extremely rare among the Indians, and the doctor knew of no instance of prolapse of the uterus. So although they had very arduous physical lives, it did hold them in good stead in childbirth because their bodies were used to rigorous living. Their diet was sparse, but again, they would not have had the high salt content no one is sure what causes toxemia exactly, but the diet in one way was good for the Indians. I'm not making that very clear. It was a Spartan diet, but even though it did not meet what would be our nutritional standards, they still seemed to not have the complications with childbirth that the white women did. The old women usually attended the cases of childbirth and went prepared with roots and herbs of some kind, which they administered with a view of promoting uterine contractions. We do know that in Minnesota they did know about ergot. They could get ergot because it grows wild in the fields with the grain. So that would be, I'm sure, is one of the ones that they used for promoting uterine contractions. They didn't know about turning the child, but they had, Dr. McMahon had heard that there were cases where they dissected the fetus in utero with no other instrument than the common scalping knife. Sort of a gruesome thing, but they did take care of it. The Indian families were small. 2 or 3 children was the average number, and 4 children was a large family. We don't have any verification, or I haven't been able to find any. I've talked to a lot of people about whether the Indians practiced birth control or whether or not they used abortion. They had a long lactation period. They usually nursed their children for 2 years, and some people say that this would prevent them from getting pregnant, but I think of all the people I know who've gotten pregnant while they're in nursing, and I'm not so sure that's right. So the white women had a harder time of it. They came out. I talked to a woman from Yale University who is teaching midwifery, and she told me that the larger groups of settlers, like the Scandinavians, when there would be a great migration, quite often they would bring the midwives with them. And so the large groups of immigrants coming in would have their own midwives. But so often of our families that came out in covered wagons where there was just one small family, the extended family was lost because the grandparents perhaps stayed behind. And this small nuclear family, again, coming out to settle on the prairie, the woman had a very difficult time getting someone to help her with childbirth. And, of course, the cemeteries are full of graves of women that have died in childbirth or infants. There's a lot of references in most of the history books about the community grandmothers, the wise women, or the local midwives, but not an awful lot has been written about them. And because of my job at the university, where I move around a great deal and see a lot of different people, it's a referral hospital so that people are from outstate in the Dakotas. And I was able to talk to a great many people. I talked to over 100 people. And because you're in a hospital, you can ask questions about did a midwife deliver you and things that you just normally wouldn't ask people. And there was a whole pattern that emerged because the eastern part of Minnesota, that's where the doctors first came, because that's where you had your riverboats, your big towns were being established. That's where Rochester came in with the Mayo Clinic. And, of course, in the cities. There you didn't find the midwives so much. The doctors did the delivering. But then the next, they turn up in southwestern Minnesota. And then the last frontier was the northern counties of Minnesota, where people were homesteading up into the 30s and 40s. And I met one very lovely family it was the Dudley family. And this was in Hubbard County. And she was one of the ones I was able to get the story of her life. And she was so typical of the bits and snatches and pieces of what I was hearing about these other women and the wonderful things that they had done. So I included her in this. She settled on the homestead in Hubbard County in 1908. She was originally from Dodd County. She was always considered a nurse. Her name was Electa Whiting Dudley. She was called upon frequently not only to be a nurse, but she was a midwife and she was also a mortician. And then there's a book of family remembrances that the family shared with me, and I took some of the quotes out of it because I thought they were good, and that people just tell very simply how they feel about their mother. With experience came confidence in herself and the confidence of her neighbors until there was hardly a home where she had an administered help of some sort. At first it was considered friendly and neighborly services, but as her services were more and more sought after, people began to realize how much more she was giving than receiving, so began offering to pay her. If she knew that they could afford it, she would accept a small fee, but if she thought even a few dollars would cause hardship, she would say, "Just bring me a sack of canning corn when it's ready," or, "I'd rather have some of those good potatoes you were showing me." She was often called upon to help the doctor if one was needed. Then the doctor would leave her in charge of the patient when he left. The doctor, by the way, was 25 miles away. So there was many, many, many times when Electa was the only one there able to be at the bedside because the doctor just couldn't get through. And again, she did what many women did, as her interest in nursing, and I don't like to say the word nursing because they did a lot more than that. Her interest in medical help and healing grew, then she read more and more books and became a very well self-educated woman. And here again, these women have turned up in many, many readings. A lot of doctors in their memoirs will quote back to my mother, who was could have been a doctor herself because of her knowledge. So again, it was very typical. The way that Electa functioned as a midwife was, if it was the first child for a woman, she would visit her ahead of time if possible, because the trust and good rapport were of the essence, and that was one of the qualities that made this rural midwifery work, was that women knew the women, and it wasn't such a terribly frightening experience as going into a sterile hospital where you know no one, although that is changing now. excuse me. If there were any predictable complications, such as hemorrhaging or, well, they wouldn't know about elevation of blood pressure, but if there were complications that were foreseeable, then the doctor was consulted. The family was requested to have ready several layers of newspaper. And I'm taking this as quotes from many people. I asked them about rural childbirth. They would bake the newspapers, if possible, to prevent infection. And also they would ask that the sheets all be freshly ironed because the hot iron was also a deterrent of infection. Electa usually specified that thread from flour sacks be available, as it was soft, pliable, and quite strong. And the family was also to hear the classic call for a basin full of hot water to sterilize the scissors for cutting the cord. This is where the white women differed greatly from the Indians, and the Indians were right, because the white women would remember the long confinements, 2-3 weeks in bed after a child was born. And the Indians were up and going right away. Well, of course, the white women got all sorts of things. You get pneumonia, you get blood clots, you get all this sort of thing. So that was another thing. She would stay with the mother for another 2 weeks. And there, it was important that these women had supportive families because they had children of their own, and the older sisters, daughters, whatever, would all take care of Electa's family while she was off taking care of others. And this, again, was true of many, many women. I talked to Maida Dudley, who was the daughter, and she herself had 12 children up there. And I asked her why there weren't more women. It seemed to be very much there'd be one or two women in each community. I talked to people down in Brown County. I talked to people in Ottertail County. I talked to people from at least 15 counties. And I always got there was always just a few women that did this. And her quote, I thought, was really fine. It just said that... It just said what everyone was saying. She replied when I asked her why there were so few. Only some women were midwives or healers. They just had to have the spirit or the knack. Other folks would help out taking care of kids and crops, but they just weren't good at the bedside. And I, even now when I go back up there, my folks have retired up in that county, and people speak. She died about 30 years ago, and she's still so well remembered. Well, of course she is. She's delivered half the township. And it was really nice. It was just such a treat to talk to these people, and they showed me so many of their old diaries and everything. I felt very privileged. Then over in Ottertail County, Amanda Anderson Hansen came from, let me see, Sweden. And she was one who came with a group of immigrants, and she was an orphan over in Sweden, and so she had a year a formal training in one of the good midwife schools in Stockholm, because it was a policy in Sweden to apprentice orphans out and to give them so that they would have a livelihood, so that they would not be dependent on state funds. Anyway, she received a special recognition from the high school graduating class of Henning, Minnesota in 1944. She delivered over half the class in a midwifery career that began in 1885. One of her most prized possessions, her granddaughter told me this, was a crockery bedpan, which she carried around on all her cases, because bedpans in those days were not too common. She brought it from Sweden with her. One time she said, terrain and the weather and everything that these people would go through, and a man had come in with a horse to pick her up. He brought one of his best horses, and she got all ready to go, and it was a dreadful blizzard out, and they came out, and the horse had run away. You think about things. There's lots and lots of notes from memoirs of doctors and nurses and midwives, et cetera, talking about. So they spent half their lives stuck in their buggies on country roads. Let's see. This is where the problem comes, is tying this all together. The first hospital in Minnesota was St. Joseph's Hospital in St. Paul. And that was started, Bishop Creighton, or Creighton is really how you say it, and around 1854, in 1853 he wanted to start the hospital, and he had gotten the land for it. Henry Rice donated the land, and the chief cloud of the Lake Calhoun Band of Chippewas furnished the lumber. Yes, that was a bad slip, excuse me. Okay, in 1854, cholera, which was one of the scourges of the time, became an epidemic in St. Paul, and cholera is one of the communicable diseases that affects the ileum or the small intestine, and although it can incubate, the symptoms can be very subtle and very virulent, and someone who's well in the morning can be dead in the afternoon, because there's tremendous vomiting and diarrhea, this sort of thing. And dehydration is there right away. And then, of course, I didn't know about intravenous feedings and all that sort of thing then. So anyhow, the cholera epidemic really pushed the opening of the hospital. The first order of nuns that had been in St. Paul were the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet, and they were put into service, and the St. Joseph's Hospital opened prematurely in the old St. Paul log chapel. When the new building opened, still the site of the present hospital, there were bathrooms on each floor, but it took the strength of four nuns to supply the power to pump the water to each bathroom. Another detraction was the location. People from the steamboats, where the lower steamboat landing, had to be transported through the swamp that was originally a part of downtown St. Paul. Except during the cholera epidemics, it was the epidemics that really got things going. I mean, nobody really cared about hospitalization beyond that. The hospital wasn't used, and so the nuns were running an academy for girls, an orphanage, and when public demand warranted it, they had a hospital. So I don't really know how they did all the things they did. In the St. Cloud area, the Benedictines, tornadoes were the other thing that got hospitals started. The New Ulm Hospital was started as a result of a tornado. St. Mary's, which I'll talk about more, was started in Rochester, was a tornado. The St. Cloud Hospital got really going because of a tornado, because all of a sudden they were hit with a disaster and all these people had to have a place to go. But the nuns, the Benedictine nuns in St. Cloud, were the first ones who got the idea of hospitalization to generate a little business. If people were to pay $8 a week, no, I can't remember the exact hospitalization. It was $10 a year, I think it was, and that would be that they could have all the hospital care that they needed for that year. And that was the first mention I had ever read about hospitalization in Minnesota. They were enterprising ladies. The one thing that would make it work in St. Cloud would not perhaps work in other areas was because families depended on their relatives so much to take care of people. And St. Cloud was a railroad town, and there were a lot of single people there, men working on the railroad, women coming through as cooks, teachers, prostitutes, whatever. Okay, then we come to the Mayo Clinic. And that was, I sort of grew up in, I lived in St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester for 3 years, so I really feel I know this story very well. I knew Chuck Mayo for a long time. I knew a lot of the people that I'll be talking about, or people who knew them. And I know when Alistair Cook had his America series on, and he spent 15 minutes on the Brothers Mayo, and he did not mention one word about the nuns, and I was so incensed. And I wrote a letter to the administrator of the hospital saying I wanted to be sure and include her in this manuscript, the hospital in the manuscript, because that was just unforgivable. It's just as if this all happened from nowhere, and women were a very, very important part of the establishing of the Mayo Clinic. Mother Alfred, now this is, so far it's been the St. Joseph nuns and the Benedictines, now come the Franciscans. And Mother Alfred, who was originally from Luxembourg, was the woman who really started the idea of St. Mary's Hospital, of having a hospital there. And she appealed to the senior doctor, Will Mayo, and he is referred to as the old doctor. Clave Saddle's book, and don't get the paperback, the hardcover book is just an excellent resource book if you're at all interested in the history of the state. It gives you lots of places to go at different areas to explore after you've read that. Anyway, this the old doctor, and she went to the old doctor with the idea of the hospital. He didn't think it could be done, but she, with the help of Bishop Ireland, got it through, and they began starting the hospital. She issued orders. She was a very, very powerful woman. She had a lot of authority, a lot of women under her jurisdiction, new orders to the sisters of her 20 schools in Minnesota, Ohio, Kentucky, and Missouri. They were to save every cent possible and send it to the mother house at Rochester. And then it goes on saying they ate soup instead of meat for some meals. They made their own soap. They did their own manual labor, such as firing the furnaces and chopping wood. They made and sold wax flowers. Several talented sisters painted pictures, and other sisters sold them. So they just did all of the nice ladylike things, but they got it done. Oh, another thing, she had opened a daycare center for preschoolers. From 3 to 6, send your children, ages 3 to 6. That was another thing she decided. Then there was a power play in there, and I don't know just what happened, but Bishop Ireland got Mother Alfred demoted. But she did get to pick her successor, who was Sister Mary Joseph. And Sister Mary Joseph, I was told this by someone who knew her, was very unhappy about being taken away from teaching and put into nursing. She didn't think she was capable of administering a hospital, but here again was the habited woman was told that she would do it, and instilled with perfect obedience, she went ahead and did things, and she did things that other women were not doing. Because just think of the things I've said so far, how much power these women were accumulating. I'll go on with this a little bit more. Edith Graham was the first, quote, trained nurse from Chicago, and she was brought in to instruct the other nurses. It's difficult to know just how far the knowledge was put into effect because they worked so terribly hard. They worked continuous shifts of one day and night and another day. They carried water from the basement to the second and third floors of the hospital. They carried trays of food from the kitchen to the same floor. After supper, they walked into town each day to do their marketing. They had no carriages. The hospital linens were laundered and ironed after supper each evening. The housekeeping in the rooms was done before the sisters' bedtime, usually about midnight. And the sisters' day began again about 4 o'clock in the morning, unless they'd been all up night before with a sick patient. A lot of the women just totally ruined their health. By 1905, there were more surgical cases at St. Mary's than at any other hospital in the United States, including Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, which is an incredible record when you think of this little hospital in a prairie town just miles and miles from nowhere. I went down and spent a day down there this spring. I talked to Sister Mary Bry, who had been the hospital administrator for many, many years, and I asked her if she thought that by the women wearing the habits, was their sexuality less threatening to men? Is that how they got to be presidents of colleges and administrators of hospitals long before other women were able to accomplish this? And her answer was that their sexuality was committed to God. They were freed of the childbearing burden and had no commitments at home. Considering the extent to which these women worked, there had to be a strong spiritual force, and it was out of roots like this that achievements came. Part of a vocation is availability. The woman was free and committed to the idea of slipping into a place where she was needed. By not having a salary, a religious felt free to go from one place to another because the money factor was not there to hold her. As far as getting the whole thing going, it was really Mother Alfred who proposed the hospital against the advice of Dr. Mayo Sr. He was just a mere man who wasn't able to foresee the future and didn't know what was in it. I thought, and Stray Bry is well into her 70s, and she is a neat lady. Let's see. I come to this let's sees all the time. The one person that I didn't even know about, and Gretchen said, "Why don't you do something about Martha Ripley?" Well, Gretchen had read the plaque at the Capitol, I guess, because nobody knows anything about Martha Ripley. Has anybody here ever heard of her? Other than Nancy. Because that's where I ran into her, all over. And I find it incredible. I went down to the Historical Society to do some work in the manuscript room, and they didn't know who she was. And she really is a very interesting person, and I don't know how we in Minnesota history have overlooked her as long as we have. She was a woman of great social awareness with the courage to speak and write her observations. She was born in November 30th, in 1843 in Lowell, Vermont. And as many New Englanders were doing, her parents left and settled in Iowa. And she came from a liberal home. They were part of the Underground Railroad. She had little formal schooling, except what was taught at home in some high school, but never graduated. She went on, she did some teaching. She married, in 1867, married William Warren Ripley and moved back east to Lawrence, Massachusetts, where William was to take over the management of a paper mill belonging to his uncle. And this is at the time of the Industrial Revolution. The Civil War was over, so the suffragists were rebanding, and she became very good friends of Lucy Stone. She was also beginning to meet, there were a lot of women doctors. Boston University was graduating a great many women doctors. In fact, most of the first women doctors in the state of Minnesota were graduates of Boston University. She had three daughters. She was very involved in the suffrage movement. And she had a very strong speaking voice and an excellent mind. She must have been a spirited figure at suffrage gatherings. At the January meeting of the Massachusetts Women's Suffrage Convention in 1881, she criticized a speaker who blamed women for men's shortcomings and declared that such meetings spent too much time discussing questions already settled. She noted the rapid changes occurring in the condition of women. They could now enter any profession and succeed if they had the ability, she said. If Harvard would not accept women, they could acquire the necessary knowledge in other places of learning. And after this, Lucy Stone invited to address the spring meeting of the New England Association, telling, "Say your own genuine say." Well, as I go on, you'll see that Martha had a lot of really good genuine says. She went on, and she got her degree in medicine. And then her husband was injured. She was Boston University. Her husband was injured in a milling accident, so it was really necessary that she support the family. He had relatives in Minneapolis, so she came back here to see about starting a medical practice in Minneapolis. There were very few doctors in town. And I want to be sure and bring this into that in about 1883, Northwestern Hospital was started by a group of lay women. There were a couple that was staffed by women. There were 43 women on the committee, and all the voting power over the whole say and running of the hospital belonged to women. So it was run by four women again. Martha then, but Northwestern Hospital served one function, and that was more for your normal the regular woman patient, but then there was this outcast of society, the unwed mother. And this is where Martha Ripley decided to establish Maternity Hospital, which perhaps, I don't know, it's no longer in its existence. It's a nursing home now. It's in northeast Minneapolis. Article 1 of the hospital constitution reads, "Its object shall be to furnish a lying-in hospital for the confinement of women who are without means or suitable abode and care at the time of childbirth. It may also admit girls who have previously born a good character, but under promise of marriage have been led astray, and may also care for destitute children born in this institution." Then the appeal for funds. The unmarried admitted to the hospital do not belong to the vicious or abandoned classes. Most of them are young women of good moral and religious training, many of them members of the various churches, and cherish both virtue and reputation, but have fallen through the temptation that they are soon to be married, and that being engaged is almost the same as being married. As one poor girl said in explanation of her conduct, "I have given all for love and lost." Shall we not, as Christians, help them through this terrible hour and thus prevent suicides, child murder, and lives of shame, and give them the hope that by right living hereafter they may redeem the past? Often these poor girls are more sinned against than sinning. Force, fraud, mock marriages, and even drugging have been resorted to in different cases. That was the appeal that went out to the public to get funds for the hospital. They started out in a small frame house in South Minneapolis, and then in a couple of other moves, they finally ended up on 5 acres of land in the Ann Kennedy residence. Well, it was really a mansion. Martha Rippey had long been aware of the double standard concerning purity for males and females. She was one of the leaders who fought to have the 1858 law regarding the age of consent and statutory rape changed from an incredible 10 years old to 18 years old in 1895. Protesting legislators argued that designing servant girls might blackmail innocent young men and boys. And the master of the house, of course. In the 1889-1891 report to the Maternity Hospital, she goes on, there's a different standard of morality for men and women. A young man may lead an impure, immoral life, and the world thinks little the worse of him. At the most, he is sowing his wild oats. It is assumed that he will steady down. No one remembers it against him. Well, his partner in sin, though she may be his victim, is degraded for life. In the past, she has had no refuge but the grave and kind-hearted women who have attempted to shelter and encourage her to lead a better life. They have been told that they are encouraging vice. So then she goes on to say that there may come a time when there'll be reformatories for fallen men. Well, you think that this woman was writing in the 1880s and 1890s. That's really right on. Pardon me, men present, but she stresses the need for sex education. We must remember that ignorance is not conducive to innocence. It relates how one mother, tears streaming down her face, brought her 14-year-old pregnant daughter to the hospital saying, I am more to blame than she is, for I never told her about these things. She also asserted, Rippey asserted, that until the standards of virtue for men are higher, the degradation of women will continue. Of course, she was working with women, and they were the women who could afford to do these sort of things were the very wealthy women of the cities. Familiar names would be, there's always been a Dayton on the board of maternity hospital, the Gates. Say the Walker was Northwestern. Very much a Wyzetta names were working because they had the money, they had the time to do this kind of thing. The chairwoman, I went through this and went through all the minutes of the hospital records is how I picked out all this material. And at the Committee on Prayer Meetings, the chairman said, there are good Christian women who pity these poor creatures and would like to help them, but have feelings of revulsion they cannot overcome. They fear they can do them no good. And then she goes on to say, I used to feel precisely so myself. See, each one is a deathless soul for whom Christ has died. A new light will break up the stolid indifference in each face. He will incline these dear girls to accept pardon and peace and begin here in this house a new life. Are they not now fit company for the good and pure, since they are fit for heaven now? And there you see the two, just Martha Rippey was doing it for totally one reason, and a lot of the women that she had working with her were doing it for other reasons. Oh, and there was one poem I have to read that was in this. It was also in the hospital report. And she was referring to the newspaper, the negative newspaper reports about unwed mothers, and they were really, really harsh. I'm sure that most of us can remember the Booth home and the attitude about unwed mothers. One more unfortunate, weary of breath, rashly importunate, gone to her death, mad from life's history, glad to death's mystery, swift to be hurled anywhere, anywhere out of this world. And this is the sort of poetry and the sort of things that were being said about these women. I don't want to spend too much time on her, but she's just so, I just really want you to know about her. She talks about adoption, and the women there felt, they had the very romanticized with the little babe left on the doorstep, but finally finding a good home, etc. But her thoughts about adoption were, it's a mistaken idea that in order to discipline these unfortunate mothers, they should be compelled to keep their babies with them. Most of the women are young, without friends or skills to maintain themselves. Her chief recommendation will be that she comes cheap, which leads to an exploitive situation damaging to both mother and child. Because the women were outcasts, they could be hired for next to nothing. And she then goes on to suggest it's far better for the child to go to a home where the baby will be loved for himself alone than to be placed with relatives where he will be a constant reminder of the sorrow that accompanies his birth. She had one episode of puerperal fever in the first home, and that was when an outside doctor came in. And that's what it said anyway. So when they decided that they were going to build the hospital, they used the cottage system, which separated the mothers, The unwed mothers before the babies were born would live in one house, the mothers would be in another house, the nursing staff would be in another house, and then there was a nursery, which was a good way of preventing infection. By 1911, Maternity Hospital cared for over 5,000 patients. Martha Ripley was the essence of the institution. She had dedicated a good portion of her life to overseeing its every need. And it was at this time that she began raising new funds, but she didn't live to see that happen. She died on April 18th in 1912. One of the tributes came from her good friend, Alice Burton. She became one of the great physicians in the country. I don't know how celebrated she may be. The plaudits of charity patients carry scarcely farther than their cries for help. But I do know that of the multitude of sufferers who asked for help, none were ever sent away empty-handed. Well, the hospital went on. Dr. Anna Hurd became the new medical director, and under her leadership, the innovations that Ripley had were continued. They were one of the first hospitals to bring in the social service. And there was also, I finally tracked it down to the health department. There was a very punitive law that said that all women must nurse their children for 3 months after they were born, unwed mothers. And it turned out to be a health department regulation. Everyone blamed it on everyone else, but then they would wonder why it was so terribly difficult for these women to give up their babies. It was just incredible. And they did this at all the different hospitals. It wasn't just at maternity. The infants home, foundling home in St. Paul, Booth, wherever there was an unwed mother, they had to do this. Then in 1948, Dr. Anne Whelan Arnold became the last chief of staff at Maternity Hospital. And she's still living, a very, very interesting woman. With the true spirit befitting a successor of Martha Ripley, she was a pioneer in the investigation of infertility and x-ray of the pelvis. And she won the Harold Dirrell Award in 1974, she's 78 now, as a fierce fighter for the right of all women to proper maternal care. It was changing. More and more women, as the idea of antisepsis, when they started knowing what caused puerperal fever, that kind of thing, more and more women were having their children in hospitals. So by the 1950s, most of these hospitals wouldn't accept unwed mothers. And in 1956, Mrs. George Dayton announced that there were no more funds and maternity hospital closed. Then the other group of women that I suppose I'm going to have to talk about are the nurses. And I would have to agree with some of the things that were said earlier, because nurses are probably about the only professional person in the world who are asked, where did you train, instead of where did you go to school? Which I always feel like a monkey when people ask. But and I catch myself doing it too. Because the general function of the nurse is so closely connected to what's been deemed women's natural role throughout history, it's difficult for the public and for nurses themselves to distinguish between the two beyond the fact that a nurse has additional skills or training. Well, it's true, when nurses first started out, it really wasn't a profession, it was an apprenticeship. And it was nurses for a long time had a difficult time getting jobs. The hospitals were using them and abusing them in the sense that they were using, not really teaching, they were using them as cheap labor. And nurses would have to go out and they would go on the registry, which functioned up through the 30s. And they would leave cards in doctor's offices and hospitals. They had 2 hours an afternoon a week off, and they worked for about $15 a week. What changed it for nurses was the war, the First World War. Then the University of Minnesota School started in 1909, and then nurses started realizing that if they wanted to get really good accreditation, if they wanted to get money, if they wanted to upgrade their profession, they were going to have to do something more about it. The Second World War created a great demand for nurses. It was in the 1930s that the baccalaureate program began almost simultaneously. St. Catherine's, St. Scholastica's, and St. Teresa's, I know, all began in the mid-30s. Again, it was the nun schools that were among the first to start. By the way, in 1909, the National Federation of Nurses met in Minneapolis, and they voted they voted down suffrage. They didn't want anything to do with it. except there were some really strong nurses, and mostly in the East, strong suffrage leaders, but it hadn't hit Minnesota. I've told you a lot of sort of vignettes of things that are happening. I'll tell you a little bit more now, what I know, what's going on right now. Midwifery, of course, has changed drastically. The midwifery department at the university is a very sought-after place for a lot of people. They had over 200 applications for 4 places last year. This gives a woman a master's degree as a midwife. She has to have her bachelor's, and then if she gets her master's. It's difficult for the women to get jobs in the city. I'm sure that's going to end up being rural again. The two midwives that are successfully practicing are in Long Prairie. They also happen to be married to the two town doctors. But women, because of what their interests are more and more going toward the midwives. Midwives are still very restricted in the sense that I talked to some of the male obstetricians over there and asked them how they felt about it, and they said, well, why should we take all the responsibility? Because the midwife still has to have the doctor backing her up if we're not going to get financially reimbursed or financial compensation. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see where it's going to go. At the University Medical School, the class, it's about a third women now. Specialties are still, there are, I ticked them off last night, 4 women in the whole surgical department. And my goodness, they are referred to as bitchy. I would be too. I think that would just be a horrendous to have to do what they have to do. The specialties that still have the most women are neurology, internal medicine, and then pediatrics and obstetrics, as you would expect. I also just incidentally, apropos of nothing, there was a woman, women have also been active in the mental health field, and there was a woman who was, psychiatry wasn't really accepted in the 1890s as a specialty here, but there were women working in the mental health field who were doctors. And they did try to organize a mental health association in the early 1890s and were forced to disband because there was no public interest or very little professional interest. I feel like I should hum or something while I... Okay, one of the other things that more and more now, we're going back to what was on like the popular health movement in the 1840s, is that women are becoming much more aware of their own potential. They're becoming much more interested in their own bodies, and they're seeking out other women like they do at the Elizabeth Blackwell Center for referrals. The idea of control of your own body with abortion, and it was a woman who paved the way there when Dr. Jane Hodgson in 1970, who openly and very courageously, whether you agree with that concept of abortion or not, it took a lot of courage to do what she did. She could have done it quietly. She could have said no. But she stood up for what she believed in. That abortion is probably one of the most lively and controversial debates among women today, and it certainly is in the medical field. There's a division of opinion. A lot of doctors and nurses feel that contradiction in value is to abort a fetus at one stage of gestation. And then should it be prematurely born, fight valiantly with sophisticated equipment to save its life. The social workers and counselors see a different aspect, the cloudy future of an unwanted child, the despair of a woman caught in a pregnancy she can't handle. I'm not trying to give any answers. I was just trying to include a lot of opinions that people have given me. Well, in summation, the tight medical structure that we have now that is very, very difficult to get through wasn't around when women were working on the frontier. There wasn't anybody. Health workers and consumers must be friends in order for this to be achieved. And this, again, has been done through there's a lot of walk-in counseling services now. There's the Rape Crisis Center. There's all sorts of things that just in the last 10 years that just weren't there before. But like the women mentioned previously, it's women working with women and for women, and certainly those women that I talked about did this, who can achieve greatly in rebuilding the medical power structure now before us. Okay.